And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for listening to us today. It is always great to be back with you, and if you wish to call in this morning, the number to call is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. On Tuesdays, it feels like it's the first time out, so we're going to be talking about a lot of things today. We're talking about politics. And it's on the national, it's on the local, it's on the state level. Governor Shumlin and I keep battling in the newspapers over the release of his travel expenses to Paris. And I'll have a few things to say in just a moment about that. The governor also, I don't understand this. The governor turned on allies last week, turned on friends, which I don't understand. And we'll share some thoughts on that. And then we'll talk about Super Tuesday. Will today be the beginning of the end for Bernie Sanders? Does he really need to win in a lot of states today to continue? And if he doesn't do well, should he stay in all the way to the convention? There's a lot of things going on in terms of what he could do if he stayed in to the convention. So let's share some thoughts on that as well. And then we'll turn to local government, and we'll speak with Jim Condos, this Vermont Secretary of State, about what is going on in Vermont in terms of voter turnout, what you are voting on today in terms of the presidential election. This is a different election than normal. You have to go in, you have to declare a ballot. And we'll talk to Jim Condos about that. And then Karen Horn, who's director of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns Policy and Advocacy Division. What issues are being discussed and voted on at town meeting today? But first, I want to talk about Governor Shumlin's Paris trip expenses. And if you remember a few weeks ago, I was fairly critical of Governor Shumlin. What I said is that he often describes himself as the transparency governor. But you just simply can't say I'm transparent. You have to do something. It requires action, definitive action, in order to make the claim to substantiate the claim that you are transparent. And what I used for an example was in December of last year, the governor Peter Shumlin, traveled to Paris to attend the United Nations Climate Change Conference. You know, nobody sort of challenges the aspect of the governor going to places. I mean, governors must travel. And when Vermonters say it, when a governor says it's important to event, even in faraway places, most Vermonters will understand the need for the trip. They will. They simply will understand the need for the trip. All they ask in return is that there is a full and accurate accounting of the trip and the benefit to the state. That's all they ask. You know, Vermonters expect that there will be expenses. There'll be all sorts of it. There'll be travel expenses. There'll be security expenses. And in December, when Governor Shumlin came back from his trip in Paris to the United Nations Climate Change Conference, upon his return, he reported that the cost of the trip was $1,251, the cost of travel for one aide. The administration reported that Georgetown University picked up the tab for the governor's transatlantic flight and lodging, and his office recently reported that Shumlin personally picked up his meals while he was in Paris. And here's what most Vermonters' response was. There was disbelief that you only spent $1,251 while the governor was in Paris of state money. Perhaps there's reasons for the suspicion, because there's a couple of things that were not included in those expenses. For example, his transportation cost in and around Paris. I went on Priceline.com this morning, looked around. The transportation cost is for a full-size car is about $200 to $250 a day. Now, you can go up to a luxury car, a Mercedes luxury car, for about $458 a day. Or you can go full hog and rent a limo that would approximately cost, for the time that the governor was in Europe, about $2,500 to $3,000. So which was it? Was it the full-size car? Was it the luxury Mercedes? Or was it the limo that the governor used in Paris? These are questions that certainly no one would have asked if up front the governor would have said, look, it costs $1,251 plus X amount for transportation or X amount for security. But excluding those costs makes one wonder what is being excluded. What were the costs, for example, the travel cost and meals of the security detail that accompanied the governor? Look, we're going to get into that in a minute because Governor Shumlin, I suspect, had a person who I like a lot, Governor Dean, respond to that this weekend in the Rutland Herald and Times Argus, and I want to get into that in a minute. But what were those costs? What were the aggregate cost of those? Unless shown otherwise, those are usually taxpayer funded expenses. Were any special accommodations made for the governor's personal benefit that needs to be added to the cost of the trip? No one knows about this because the administration continually refuses to release them, claiming, to me, it's unbelievable that they are matters of security. You know, this is a stretch. This is a really big stretch. First of all, the trip is in the past, so it flies in the face that these expenses would pose a security threat. And Governor Shumlin had Governor Dean sort of write an op-ed, and I want to get into that because he talked about that in just a moment in terms of that, whether it is a security threat. But taxpayer-funded expenses should be easily released without compromising security protocols. And I'll give him some examples of how he can do that in just a minute. Second, here's the logic that really should be concerning to most Vermonters, the press, everyone else that's out there. What's to prevent the administration from keeping other expenses secret by running them through the Department of Public Safety and arguing they are not subject to public disclosures? And like I said, governors, look, they got to travel. We don't begrudge any governor for traveling wherever they go. That's not the issue here. The whole issue is whether the expenses should be accounted for in a variety of ways. How do we know what the expenses are? And again, no one begrudges the governor for having security. We want him to have security. And certainly, right after the Paris attacks, we would expect security would be accompanying the governor. So there is absolutely no reason not to list them as expenses when you're saying $1,200 was the cost of the trip. No, it wasn't. Because we don't have the transportation cost in there. We don't have the security cost in there. You know, as the saying goes, if you have nothing to hide, you hide nothing. And to many, it appears that the administration was so nervous about the cost of this trip and how it would be perceived by Vermonters that they intentionally decided to only disclose some costs but not others. That suggests, and here's the problem with this, that suggests to Vermonters that there's something that they don't want us to see. It looks like they're trying to hide something from us. If they had simply disclosed everything up front, and they don't have to itemize it, if they would have simply said this was X amount of dollars for the trip, then none of this would have been an issue. Right now, here's what they're trying to do. They're trying to give these contorted explanations that are very problematic. They've had problems in the past trying to be too political and too cute with the information And there's examples all over the place. You know, for delaying the single-payer health care cost analysis, you know, until after the governor's election, to downplaying the Vermont Health Connect problems as a nothing burger, or reporting only half of the impact of a large payroll tax increase in a budget speech. There is this growing feeling, and the administration has to realize this, that when it comes to these sort of things, they do not provide full disclosure of information. And this withholding of the expenses only adds to that perception. You know, over the weekend, and let me sort of preface this. I like Howard Dean. We've always had a very, very good relationship. We don't agree politically on some issues, but he's always been a gentleman to me, and I always respect him for being a gentleman. During the transition from Governor Dean to Governor Douglas, he was very, very supportive and helpful in many respects. He would come down sometimes when I was doing on the fifth floor, getting ready for the budget, and give some perspective on things. And I've always appreciated that. He's always sort of appointed me to positions that I was grateful for in this. He was he published an op-ed. It says, "Dean, don't play politics with security," and is in direct response to my call for the security expenses. And look, I know how this goes. You know, he was probably asked by the administration. Remember, Shumlin's communications team, his head of communications, Sue Allen, was Dean's head of communications. So I understand this. He was probably asked to do this. But what you're bringing out Howard Dean on expenses, you should be bringing out Howard Dean on things like healthcare and those sort of things. And in his editorial, his op-ed, Dean says, "Don't play politics with security." What he says, what's inexcusable is that he would play politics with the security of the governor and the state troopers who are charged with keeping the governor safe. Mike claims he wants to know specific itemized details of what he believes were incurred by the governor's security detail in Paris. I didn't say that, but that's what Dean said. Publicizing such information would reveal patterns and potential vulnerabilities in security procedures, which could be exploited by those who want to harm the governor or any governor. Disclosing itemized cost would give insight into critical procedures such as the size of the security detail or how the governor is protected. Publicizing that information would put the governor and the troopers on his detail at risk. Now, there's a couple of things here. You know, one of the things that he says, that I'm nothing more than a political operative. You know, those are the words of Governor Shumlin and Sue Allen, his press secretary. Look, what Governor Dean says here is releasing all the expense of the Paris trip confirms two things to me, at least. And it acknowledges something that the Shumlin administration has refused to acknowledge so far. There are additional expenses beyond the $1,251 reported. That's what that op-ed confirms to me. And when you got nothing, you sort of try to label it as political. That's the secret in politics. You try to destroy the seeker of information that you don't want to be discovered. And that's what's being done here. Look, they can call me names. It doesn't make any difference. You know, I'm pretty secure in who I am and what I am. And if you want to label me with, you know, political operative, even though, you know, I haven't run a campaign other than my own way back in the 70s, and go right ahead. That's fine with me. But the reason these are not related to security are a couple of things. One, there is no exemption for these types of expenses. I am confident that if somebody went to court on this, they would find there's no exemption for these types of expenses. If you are doing procedures, and let's go to what is being said here, is that if you reveal patterns and potential vulnerabilities, you know, it is a security procedure. Look, if you're doing things the same way, you've got a huge security problem. So if you are doing procedures and policies the exact same way at different locations, as Governor Dean explains why these expenses should not be released, then boy, you've got a security problem. Second, or third in this case, this is an event that has happened in the past. There's no security risk. And then what I said before, what's to prevent the administration or future administrations from hiding expenses? You can easily aggregate some of these security issues in order to do that. The plain fact is the administration does not want to release these expenses, and you've got to ask the question, why? And it seems like, and this is something that I have noticed, the governor is starting to lash out to people. Governor Shumlin is starting to lash out at people that and attack people for all sorts of things. And his administration, particularly his communications people, are spearheading this attack. And it leads to the question, why are they doing that? And of course, what they're trying to do is change the legacy trajectory that he is currently on. Right now, he's known for Vermont Health Connect, the failed single payer, and some other things that are going on. He doesn't want to do that. He wants to change the trajectory of his legacy. So he's grappling on to other issues, whether they're divestment, which I want to talk about in just a moment, or there are other issues that are out there. And the way that he's doing it is going after people and going after people aggressively. And one of the things that surprised me, really, really surprised me, was the governor went after a huge ally of his last week. It was Senator Dick Mazza, who has always been there for the governor, has carried the governor's water. But they disagree on several issues. They disagree on marijuana. They disagree on divestment. And this is what the governor's office went after him for. They disagreed on the small business exemption for the paid sick leave bill. But these are issues that you normally disagree with someone. And the governor's office, the governor's spokesman, Scott Coryell, went after Senator Dick Mazza personally, basically calling him a Republican. And Dick Mazza was mad. And I don't blame him for being mad, because, look, Dick Mazza has been a Democrat since 1960. Think about that. Governor Shumlin was probably in diapers in 1960. Scott Coryell wasn't born until perhaps even 25 years later than that. And yet they have the nerve to call him a Republican. Look, Senator Dick Mazza. Mazza was a Democrat in Vermont before being a Democrat was cool. It was run by the Republicans at the same time. It would have been easy for him to be a Republican, but he wasn't. He was a Democrat. Where's the loyalty here? And if you want to talk about divestment, I mean, issued today in the Rutland Herald, a Middlebury College professor is arguing divestment of fossil fuel companies will not stem the flow of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. One of the things that, look, you're always going to disagree on things. You're always going to have disagreements on various issues. I understand that. But why do you attack a friend? I'll tell you why. The legacy is more important than the friend. So that is some of the things that are going on. I want to change the subject in just a moment, but I also want to take a phone call. So let's go to Eric in, I think, Barrytown. Eric, are you in Barrytown?
Johnson. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you, Eric?
Good. Mike, you... Peter Sumlin is not truthful. That Dodge deal he did a couple years ago showed his true colors. And I'm a Democrat, but that showed... That was a stunning example of the type of person he is, and this doesn't surprise me one bit. So,
I mean, I'm a little stunned that they're going to the wall on these expenses, because everybody expects these expenses to be there.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't understand what, because it leads to this question, Eric. What are they trying to hide? What
Absolutely.
Are they trying to do? And that's never a good position to be in. These are not exempt, you know. These are not exempt expenses, and yet we're thrown up all these roadblocks. And like I said, when I looked at the transportation costs, you know, you can go from anywhere from $100 a day to $3,000 for these transportation costs. And all you have to do is, you know, nobody's going to, unless you got a limo or something like that.
Right. No one cares.
No one cares. So,
right. So
I just don't understand that. And are you baffled by this too, Eric?
Oh yeah. I mean, other than it doesn't surprise me, because that the whole Dodge deal with him buying that property from taking advantage of Mr. Dodge, that I lost all respect for the governor as soon as I read about that. I was done. It was like, you know, there's certain things that show a person's true colors, and that was unconscionable.
Well, that, Eric and friends, you know, I always talk about this I've talked about this before on this broadcast, and I'm looking at Tom right now because I'm getting a little bit of a tinny sound on my microphone here. But I have talked about this in terms of loyalty, being loyal to those that got you here and being loyal to those that you work for. And I think that's important. So, you know, those are some of the things that I do. What we're going to turn to in just a moment is Bernie Sanders, and I just find fascinating what is going to be happening with Bernie Sanders in the next week or so, because that's going to say a lot about where he's headed in his campaign. Let's go to Fred in Moncton Ridge. Fred, I haven't heard from you in a long time. How you doing, pal?
I'm doing very well. Your Republican is showing this morning. It's hanging out all over the place.
You know, Fred, it isn't my Republican. It's
well, you got dissed then by somebody because you're PO'd today, and you really took this personally, I guess, didn't you?
No, I take disclosure as personally. I do.
I think you're nickel diamond, honest to God. I mean, I really do. I think, I just can't understand why you're not bringing up something a little more important. You know, I don't think this nickel dime stuff is getting anywhere.
You just
sound like a typical Republican this morning.
Yeah. Do you think Fred, I love you. I really do. Do you really think that not releasing expenses is a good thing? I mean, if a Republican was doing it, would you have a problem with that?
Does not make one bit of difference what the D or R after the name was. Security is security. And I think we just ought to let it lay there.
What happened? Let me ask you this.
There's other things that we can pick up that are spending millions and tens of millions of dollars, and you're worried about a couple of grand that he was using on a trick.
So let me.
You sound like Michelle Bachmann this morning with against about the $200 million that Barack Obama was going to spend to go to India.
What's first of all, my voice is lower, I hope, Fred, than Michelle Bachmann. But second,
not much.
Second of all, look, I do think it's important. Let's just take the transportation costs. Is it a Cadillac or is it a Mercedes limo? What
doesn't make any difference to me. But whatever he's driving over there to make him feel like he's having a good time in France and doing what the people want him to do, that's fine by me. That's a nickel dime deal.
Okay, Fred. I thank you for your opinion on that. Fred obviously disagrees with me, and I don't mind being disagreed. Fred, thank you for your call, and I was wondering if you were going to call in again, and thank you very much. When we come back, I want to switch this to Bernie Sanders. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. This is Mike Smith. We're switching subjects. We had a sort of a response to Governor Shumlin's sort of trip to Paris, you know, position. But we're switching subjects now, and that is, where is Bernie Sanders going to go after today? You know, I give the Rutland Herald and Times Argus a lot of credit for the editorial that they wrote over the weekend. It took a lot of guts. I don't know if I would have written the same editorial, but they did. And I guess that's why they won the Pulitzer Prize, because they had guts. And they, and if you look at the comments on 7 days, because 7 days reported that they had endorsed Clinton, you can see why it takes a lot of guts. There was a lot of animosity directed at the Rutland Herald Times Argus. And boy, I give them a lot of credit. And like I said, I don't know if I would have written the same editorial. But you know what? They did. And they deserve some credit for taking a position that's contrary to what most 83% of Vermonters feel. And it is that they endorsed Hillary Clinton over the weekend. They said, and I'm not going to read the whole editorial, I'm just going to do excerpts from the editorial, but they said Sanders' outsider status, which he has enjoyed, does not automatically confer wisdom or ability. Clinton's experience as a hardworking, policy-oriented senator and a secretary of state who restored the good name of the United States weighs heavily in her favor. The contest between Clinton and Sanders has been framed as a choice between pragmatism and idealism, between incrementalism and boldness. Framing it that way oversells what Sanders offers. Fighting for health care reform, as Clinton has done for a quarter of a century, has been an exercise in idealism. It has been a long, difficult fight. And it goes on to talk about the fact that no one will argue that Clinton is the best possible candidate. She is not as natural as a campaigner, and her shifty rhetoric often undermines trust. But Sanders' experience as a national campaigner is thin, and his position at the far end of the political spectrum makes him vulnerable to Republican attacks. Change is occurring at the grassroots, with new involvement by activist groups focusing on the economic issues that Sanders has championed for years. As a leader, you know, this goes on to basically conclude, meanwhile, Clinton's foreign policy is a plus, though not without failure of judgment. We do not need a foreign policy neophyte in office in this dangerous time. And Vermonters are proud of Sanders, proud that people across the land are feeling the burn. It is thrilling to enlist in a movement, unless one's better judgment points in a different direction. And in this election year, our direction is towards Clinton. So what do you feel? I mean, it was an interesting editorial in the Rutland Herald Times Argus, where they endorsed Hillary Clinton over Vermont's Bernie Sanders. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Tuned in a little late to hear Fred going after you. I didn't hear any of the comments or what we were talking about before, but so you're a Republican now, really?
I think you would disagree, Rob, the way some of my positions. I am being labeled by the Shumlin administration as a political operative, which is, you know, what they want to do, I guess. What they do is they try to intimidate, try to defame, try to, you know, label people, and that is people that they don't agree with. And by the way, people that are their friends, which is something that I find particularly appalling. But, you know, Rob, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever a government tries to, I don't care if it's state level, local level, national level, you know, it goes on around us, but when you try to degrade someone in the media for expressing something, I don't even know, what is this angst? I'm totally in the dark about what...
Yeah, it was over, we're battling in public over the aspect of him releasing, what they did is released the Paris trip costing $1,200, but... that isn't the true cost, and they're refusing to release the cost of transportation in Europe while they were there. They're refusing to release the security issues, and they're saying that those security issues primarily are confidential because you do not want security to be, you know, you don't want people to know what security's procedures and policies are. And my response to that is you can aggregate some of those costs to not reveal that. And secondly, if you've got security doing the exact same thing in place after place after place, you've got a security problem, because that is not the way to do security. You want to, I can just simply imagine if when I was in SEAL team, if we would have done each outing that we did, if we would have done it in the exact same manner, because we would have been, you know, we would have compromised if we did it in the exact same manner. So, you know, if they're talking about compromising security because you do it over and over and over again, you shouldn't be doing it over and over again. So that was the issue. Shumlin and his spokespeople are battling over these expenses. I don't mind the battle. I think it's a disclosure issue, and I think it's an issue that they brought up by saying it was only $1,200. Most people knew it wasn't only $1,200.
Well, it sounds kind of silly in itself. But, yeah, I mean, I think when the press demands honesty and transparency from those in government, that's a good thing.
Well, it's not only that, Rob. I mean, he has proclaimed himself the transparency governor, and all of a sudden he's not giving expenses. So, you know, you tell me.
Oh, you mean like the transparency president in 2008? How government was going to be so transparent, and we would see all of the bills days before they were enacted upon, so the people out here could read it and understand it and have some input. That never happens. Transparency in government is kind of a fantasy, and really, but I think whenever a government official publicly, this is all public. I see, I'm not really up on Vermont politics that much, but you know, I lived there a long time, and whenever they start to label you, brand you as a conservative, supposedly, I mean, I think Jim Douglas debunked that. Whenever you're branded a conservative in Vermont, that's supposed to be ruin your brand. I don't think your brand's going to be ruined. I mean, and I'm sorry that that's happening to you, Mike, because I know you're an honest guy, and I know you're not a Republican. And if you are...
I am a Republican. I mean, let's face it. I mean, I served in a Republican administration, but...
And from that sense, right. But I think you're open-minded. I mean, personally, I like to consider myself an independent, you know. I go with the issues. I go with what makes more sense to me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've said on air long before I was calling in and you were there that I voted for Ross Perot. And I voted for Jimmy Carter. I didn't think Reagan, you know, these things that are being said about Bernie not being ready, I didn't think Reagan was ready. I just didn't. And all of Jimmy Carter's faults, you know, and there were some. But, you know, as Bill Clinton said, if you want a perfect candidate, don't vote for me, because nobody's perfect. So you have to kind of weed out what's more important at that point.
Well, I heard a quote over the weekend that said, if you want somebody that totally agrees with you, then vote for yourself. So that's us. Hey, Rob, thank you very much for your phone call. Got a question out there. Is this the beginning of the end for Bernie Sanders? Does he really need to win today? Should he stay in if he doesn't do well today? What is your opinion? We talked about the Rutland Herald. The Rutland Herald Times-Argus did a... did something that I didn't expect this weekend. They endorsed Clinton. And, of course, who knows where the Burlington Free Press is on their endorsements. They don't write editorials on a day-to-day basis. They only do it on Sunday, and usually it's pretty wishy-washy in terms of their editorials. You know, what the Rutland Herald Times Argus did took a lot of guts, and I guess that's, you know, as I said earlier, that's the reason why they win the Pulitzer Prize. They have a lot of guts in terms of what they do. So what is your opinion on Bernie Sanders? Does he really need to win today? Should he stay in if he doesn't win? Is this the beginning of the end for Bernie? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's just look over the landscape today in terms of Super Tuesday. And tomorrow we're going to do a whole analysis on it. We're going to bring in our analyst and talk about what happens today. That will be on tomorrow's show. But if you look at it, Bernie's got to shift the momentum right now. And he's got to have some strong showings in Colorado, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma. He will have a strong showing here in Vermont. I mean, that's a given. But he needs to have strong showings in those states as well. He's got to avoid being blown out in the southern states. He's got to avoid having a repeat of what happened in South Carolina when he only got 29% of the vote. That was a blowout in South Carolina. So those southern states like Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, and also in Texas, you know, that's Texas awards 200 delegates. So, you know, those are the areas where he can't afford to be blown out. Now, a lot of these places have proportional delegates. So, you know, winning somewhere is going to help you. And then, you know, and the reason I ask, does it really matter? Should Bernie stay in? Because if you look at the calendar later on in March, states like Nebraska and Kansas and Maine, they actually may be good for Bernie. So does he stay in? Does he stay in and hope that Hillary stumbles along the way? For Hillary Clinton today, the best case Super Tuesday for her is pretty simple. Take what she did in South Carolina and replicate that in the South, and then take most of the states in that are also up for grabs, Colorado, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oklahoma. If she can replicate what she did in South Carolina, that does not bode well for Bernie Sanders. But at the same time, should Bernie Sanders stay in or should he get out? You know, there's a lot of controversy swirling around Hillary Clinton, and it always is. The Clintons are notorious for all the controversy that surrounds them. Should Bernie wait and go to the convention, all the way to the convention? He said he is all the way to the convention for this nomination. If you have an opinion, will today be the beginning of the end for Bernie Sanders? Does he really need to win? And should he stay in if he doesn't do well today? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bill in Barry. Bill, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. This is what I think. I think you should stay in for this reason. I think the voters in all the states have the right to have a choice. And we have that right today, and I'm going to be exercising in a few minutes. But I think, and it'll help us, but I think this applies to both parties. If it is given to somebody, if I'm getting out and there won't be any contest, this will disenfranchise in some ways all of these other voters that haven't had a chance to vote. But I also think that the longer it goes, the more we learn about all the different candidates, and as you know, at least on the Republican side, you know all the negatives, or you know a lot of the negatives, and we're going to know more negatives and more positives as it goes along. So therefore, we have a right. I think that the state of Vermont today is going to help Bernie decide to stay in. I hope he decides to keep it going, And I hope on both sides they decide to keep it going for that reason.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. Let's go to Williston. There's a call from Williston. You're on open mic. Good morning.
Morning. How you doing?
Great, thank you. What can I do for you?
I guess my take on this is we're seeing Joe Biden being lifted in this scenario. You saw him at the Academy Awards. He's been appointed the cancer czar to defeat cancer by Barack Obama. So if it comes down and Hillary ends up doing the perp walk at the convention, what are they going to do here? Are they going to pull a 1968 all over again?
That's an interesting question. I mean, they'll have Bernie. They've got to go with Bernie, I would think. I mean, how else would you go if he stays in and he goes all the way to the convention? And if there,
well, the delegates will still be up for people, those super delegates, and then maybe maybe the people in the Democratic Party will finally wake up to the point that they've been on the plantation all these years, and how this all works out, and that just shut up and vote for Hillary.
Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic. What should Bernie Sanders do? Is this the beginning of the end for Bernie Sanders? Does he really need to win today, or should he stay in? Let's go.
I think he should stay in. I don't think it's a matter of just about the election. It's about his movement. And the big question is what happens going down the road to the movement, the progressive movement, much like the Tea Party movement. If you look at the vote he's tallying, I think nationally, I think you may end up with about 30% of the, you know, the Democratic, the liberal vote. But in the national election, that represents what, 15%, since we're about a 50-50 country? What does that mean for the movement? Much like the Tea Party movement was big for a while, now it's kind of petered out a little bit, although it is still there. That's the question. Are they going to find out they're not quite as big as everyone thinks they are? Or maybe they are. Maybe it is a huge movement, and maybe there is a move both sides of the aisle, you know, to the extremes. And I don't know what the answer is for that one, but it's interesting, and I'm going to watch it play out.
Thanks, Paul, for your call. Paul is saying Bernie should stay in. Stay in past today. And again, you know, even if he gets blown out, like he did in South Carolina, he should stay in. So what's your opinion? Does he really need to win? Should he stay in if he doesn't do well today? Do you think this is the beginning of the end for Bernie Sanders? Would be interested in your opinion. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Steve and Barry. Steve, you're on open mic.
Yes, I think the Democratic election is rigged too with the super delegates. I mean, already they're putting all of these delegates in Hillary's camp, and to me, I think he should go all the way to the convention.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Steve. I mean, if you look at the superdelegates and what they have won so far, and I have not sort of recalculated it since South Carolina, but they were fairly close on the delegates that they have won so far. But when you put it in with the superdelegates, you know, Hillary Clinton already has, I don't know, 580 or thereabouts delegates. Bernie has around 70, 75 delegates. So it is lopsided right now. The interesting thing is Bernie can still collect delegates, not in the same proportion that Hillary Clinton does if she wins in these states, but he still collects delegates, and he still has delegates all the way to the convention. If the scenario that the gentleman from Williston had talked about, if there was some sort of stumble by Hillary Clinton, then I would suspect the superdelegates would go his way. But you think he should stay in?
I do, and I think there's a quite good possibility that Hillary will stumble. You know, the Clinton Foundation's under investigation. They have a lot of issues with that, and who knows what will come to light between now and when the Democrats meet.
Hey,
And when it comes, push comes to shove, you know, if Bernie doesn't get the nod, I'll still write him in. I think there's a big grassroots movement that would do that.
Thanks, Steve, for your phone call. Let's go to John in Burlington. John, you're on open mic. Good morning, John.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. You know, as a longtime listener to the Mark Johnson Show, I really am getting tired of the partisanship approach that this program is taking these days. For example, last week, one day, you had a one-half-hour infomercial for Rubio with this congressman from California.
John,
irrelevant to Vermont politics.
Let me just stop you.
It was very timely because you did that right about the same time that a bunch of Republican legislators and Phil Scott signed on to Rubio in a desperate attempt to stop Donald Trump.
John, let me just stop you there. I will have anybody on this show that wants to call in. If Bernie Sanders wanted to have his people call in, that is fine with me. If Hillary Clinton wanted her people, by the way, in New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton's surrogates were much more on this program than anybody. So I try to be as fair as I can. Now, you said a half hour. It was 15 minutes. I will have anybody that wants to be on this program to be on this program. That's why I don't screen calls, John. That's why I do what I do here. I take your call. I take Fred from Moncton's call. I appreciate those calls. I appreciate people disagreeing with me. The partisanship, if you're talking about partisanship, if you're a Republican and you were in New Hampshire, you would think, you know, when I was doing the primary down there, you would think that I was for Hillary Clinton because I had her surrogates on a lot. But they were around. They asked to be on the program. If the Rubio people want to be on, if the Kasich people want to be on, if the Clinton people want to be on, if the Sanders people want to be on, they can be on this program. All they have to do is ask. And if you think about it, if you look at the legislative lineups that I have on Friday, I try to be extremely fair in those. But, John, I thank you for your call. I know you called in before. I know you have a problem with me being on another show, and that's your opinion, and I thank you for it. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. I just realized, Tom, that John from Burlington is the same person who criticized me for going on another show that features other people that appear on that show, like Peter Welch and the mayor of Burlington and other prominent Democrats and other prominent Republicans and other prominent business people. John seems to have a problem with me. So, you know, I'm sorry, John, that you do have a problem with me, but I've been trying to be fair to both sides here. But I will bring up issues when I have an opinion. I will bring up issues when I see things that I think are wrong. So thank you very much. Let's go to Bob in Plainfield. Bob, you're on Open Mic. We're talking about Bernie Sanders. Does he really need to win?
Before Bernie, with regard to your previous caller, to suggest that Mark Johnson wasn't a little biased on his program, as good as Mark was, is a little bit ridiculous, and I think Mark would even admit so. But anyway, as far as Bernie is concerned, sitting on a pile of cash, you have ongoing investigations, he'd be foolish to get out of the race.
So you think it's best for him to stay into this race and go to the convention?
Absolutely, he should do that. He owes it to his constituents or potential constituents, and so he should stay the course. Super Tuesday is one thing, a lot of delegates at stake. By the same token, there's a long road ahead until the convention.
Hey, Bob, thank you for your call. I wanted to we talked about the Democratic side in terms of what has to happen today, in terms of who will be the winner, who will be the losers as you look at it, and where they're winning and where they're losing. You know, if we look on the Republican side, Donald Trump, you know, his best case scenario is that he keeps his streak alive, that he sort of runs the table here. And, you know, again, delegates will be awarded proportionately. So the key in all of this is who comes in second. And who is going to be the challenger to Donald Trump from there on? And it appears it's either Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz. And Marco Rubio seems to be, if you look at all the rest of the states, he seems to be in second place, other than Texas, where Cruz is expected to win in Texas. And if Cruz doesn't win in Texas, that would be a problem for Cruz, Ted Cruz. The second thing is, how close does Donald Trump come to Cruz, and can he snatch Oklahoma and Arkansas from second place is ahead of Rubio. That's going to be the interesting thing. It looks like Donald Trump is on his way to the nomination. So is this going to get down to a two-person race pretty quickly? And who is going to be that second person? John Kasich, I mean, he was in, you know, Vermont over the weekend. He's only campaigned in five states: Virginia, Massachusetts, Vermont, Tennessee, and Georgia. And I think he's holding on, trying to get a win in Michigan on March 8th, and then Ohio a week later. So it's going to be interesting. The question we've been asking this morning, and we're running up to the top of the hour, so if you're going to get a call in. I think I can take one more phone call, and it's going to have to be really quick. Dick from St. Albans. Dick, we got about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, and I can give it to you. You need to read the book, The Conspiracy to Destroy All Existing Governments and Religions by William Guy Carr, and that'll explain exactly what's going on right now.
Thanks, Dick. I appreciate it. I don't know about destroying all religions. I think there's an issue. It's good to be spiritual, whether you believe in a religion or not. It's very good to be spiritual. It sort of keeps you grounded in terms of spirituality. I think that is important. I don't know. You know, I don't want to get this into a talk about spirituality and religion, but it's going to be interesting. What's going to happen? We're going to change in the second hour. We're going to change up. We're going to have Jim Condos. We're going to be talking about local issues. Jim Condos, the Secretary Secretary of State, will be on, and also Karen Horn from the Vermont League of Cities and Towns will be on. And then tomorrow, we'll be talking about what happens today with our analysts Steve Terry and Eric Davis. Of course, you can always hear this program on our podcast by going to WDEVradio.com and clicking on the Open Mic podcast icon. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And as I said, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Let's turn to our colleagues down in D.C., Talk Media News, and on the line this morning is Ellen Ratner. Good morning, Ellen.
And good morning. Well, I'm not in D.C. today. I'm in New York because I'm doing Fox News from 1 a.m. to 4 a.m. with election analysis, so I had to get here.
How'd you get that shift, Ellen?
I don't know. I've actually done it on many elections, so I'm back doing it. And of course, Vermont is people are looking at it. They are looking at it to see if Bernie Sanders does a blowout in his home state.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious. The latest VPR poll had him winning in this state with 83% of the vote. So it's going to be interesting. How's he going to do elsewhere, though? That's the question.
Well, of course, Massachusetts is going to be neck and neck. Hillary Clinton was up a couple points, but within the margin of error on that one. And the other big state in play is Minnesota, because the southern states are clearly going to go to Hillary, I think. I don't think that's much of a question, and I think Bernie Sanders expects that.
Do you think he expects the same results that he had in South Carolina? That was a blowout in South Carolina.
Well, I don't know that it will be such a blowout, but she's definitely going to probably win the southern states. She has a lot of the black vote, and that's very important in those states.
And those southern states are Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, and Texas, which has more than 200 delegates. That's a big state.
A lot of people think that it is essentially the Southern Conference. Now, Texas has, as some of these other states, it's not a winner-take-all, but it's a winner-take-most. And you have to get above a 50 percentile and have, I think in most of these states, some states differ, a 20%, you have to reach a ledge of 20% to get any delegates. So it's kind of complicated.
Ellen, what happens? What happens if what is predicted happens, that Bernie takes Vermont, maybe Massachusetts? It doesn't look you know, like there are other states out there that are for the, maybe Nebraska, excuse me, Nebraska is the next time, but maybe Minnesota and Oklahoma or Colorado. But what happens if it's two states? Does he stay in?
I think he does stay in. He's got the money, and why not try and make it to Super Tuesday, the second Super Tuesday, which isn't as super, but in 2 weeks. I mean, he's got nothing to lose by staying in for the next 2 weeks. Nothing to lose. And he's got the money, so why not?
Right, and in a couple of weeks, he's got Nebraska, Kansas, and Maine. That would probably be more favorable to him in those states, which is interesting. She seems to be destined for a pretty big night tonight. Is that what you're thinking?
Yes, and she's going to be in Florida, where, of course, there's going to be another Democratic debate, pretty much. And so she will be in Florida tonight, as Donald Trump will be. So how does Donald do in your home state? I'm asking you. I'm supposed to be reporting the news, but I'm asking you.
Well, let me give you, he is up in this state. The last poll, last week it was released on Monday of last week. It had him up almost 32% over Rubio, who was the next one down at 16%. Kasich and Cruz were right around 10%. So it looks like Donald, if the poll is accurate, Donald Trump will win Vermont, which is astonishing to me, actually. I didn't think Donald Trump would win Vermont, but it looks like he's going to win Vermont. And Bernie will win big here with 83%, according to the poll. So that's going to be interesting. And the interesting thing for me is that who's going to be in second place tonight? Because it looks like Donald Trump is going to have a big night across the country in the Super Tuesday. But Marco Rubio, they need to thin the herd down here really quickly.
They do need to thin the herd down, but you have people such as Dr. Ben Carson that are vowing to stay in the race till the end.
Yeah, because it is a fight between Cruz and Rubio who's going to be the second person, isn't it? Isn't that the whole establishment?
Oh, that is definitely the fight. But then you have some other hangers-on. And you have Kasich, who says that he wants to win Ohio, which I believe is in 2 weeks from today.
Right. You have him looking at Michigan and Ohio, Michigan on March 8th, and then capturing Ohio's 66 delegates a week later. So it's really going to be interesting. Any predictions tonight?
I have stopped predicting. I'm really bad at it. But I do want to talk about one other really important thing, and that's the Apple case.
Yeah,
they are going to be today testifying before the House Judiciary Committee. It will be the lead counsel for Apple, including also the FBI director on the other side and the New York attorney, or I guess he's not the attorney general, but whatever, the New York equivalent of the attorney general of New York will also be testifying. Now, what's so interesting is that, one, the cell phone was owned by the county of San Bernardino, so why can't they request that it somehow get open? And we do know that they have the technology. They claim they don't, and that's Apple's big claim, but other people say you can forensically get into some of this.
Ellen, as always, thank you very much for your time and your expertise. That's Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News. We appreciate your time. Coming up next, Secretary of State Jim Condos, and we'll talk about the election, what to expect when you walk in to vote today. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Secretary of State, Vermont Secretary of State, Jim Condos. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
Great, thank you. Hey, what are you seeing out there in terms of turnout, or is it just too early to predict?
It's way too early to predict, but let me just give you some numbers that, from a historical perspective, if you look at the 2008 when President Obama ran the first time, let's do the primary voter registrations first. It was about 422,000 registrations. From January to March of that year, we had an increase of 6,000 voter registrations. In 2012, there was 443, so it was about 22,000 more, 21,000 more but there was actually a small decrease from January to March that year. But this year, we're back up to the 442,000 registrations, but we've had an increase since December 31st of about 14,000 voter registrations, including 10,000 just this month alone, this past month.
Jim, do you think that's Bernie? That's
Well, there's probably. I mean, first of all, I think there's a couple of factors going on. I think one, you've got lively debates in both parties for this race for the presidential primary. Two, you've got Bernie on the ticket from Vermont, and three, we now have an online voter registration system which is working superbly.
What? Would you explain, there's a difference in this election than any other election in that you have to go in and actually ask for a ballot. Can you explain that as the difference when people go in today?
Yeah. Actually, it's been this way since 1996 for the presidential primary when both national parties, Republicans and Democrats, they actually wanted Vermont to go to a closed primary with party registration, which Vermont, as everyone knows, does not have party registration. Vermont, being an independent-minded state and people, said, no, we don't want to do that. So the compromise, and I believe it was Senator Doyle was on the committee when at the time, they negotiated a compromise where we would have, for the presidential primary alone, you would have to declare which ballot you want, and the town clerk is required to record that so that anybody could have it, any public, it's a public, it goes into the public record as a public record. So it started in 1996, and every 4 years, that's what happens. You have to declare your ballot, which party ballot you want, and then you get to vote on that ballot only.
And what happens to your name once you get sort of identified as either a Republican or Democrat? Does that become knowledge for the parties to use? Is that why they wanted this change?
That's exactly what they wanted. But we're still an open primary state. So, you know, Republicans or Democrats can vote in each other's primaries. Independents can vote in either primary. There's no restriction. You're not guaranteed that person is voting for your party. If you look over history, you can kind of get a feel for it. Like if Mike Smith voted straight R, you know, for the last three presidential elections, there's a good chance that you're a Republican, and vice versa if Jim Kindos votes Democrat, the same thing. So I think it's really.
By the way, Jim, I bet that's the case.
You think? but it is a public record. You're on this particular instance, it's considered a public record.
Hey, Jim, what are some of the hot button issues that you're seeing out there in terms of other things that are not presidential issues?
Well, you know, I mean, I think down in the Rutland or the Times Argus, I should say, there's been the news reports about Barry's voting on a chicken ordinance. This has to do with chickens in backyards.
Right, they want to move it from 30 feet to 60 feet, if I remember
something
correctly.
Something like that. And I live in Barrie, so I don't pay too much attention to that one. But in some of the other central Vermont towns, I think Barrie Town, Barrie City, Montpelier, and Berlin are all have a ballot question for local options tax. In Montpelier, I know there's a ballot question for the Nature Center to help give them some seed money. In Burlington, you've got the North Avenue lane configuration question on the ballot. Down in Rutland City, they're having a ballot question about a bond issue, $2.5 million bond issue for new community pool. So, I mean, you know, every town has its own ballot questions, and we don't really follow those, so to speak, except that we get involved because people are asking us questions, whether it be regarding the petitions or, the process or procedures to make sure everything's being done right.
We're speaking with Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos. We're talking about the town meeting and the presidential primaries. Jim, this is a state holiday, but I got to believe that all of your people are in today.
The entire elections team is in the office. We're answering the phones and checking our emails to help town clerks. And I do want to give a shout out to the town clerks. They work so hard leading up to this, and then today is a very stressful day for them. They hope that it goes off without a hitch, as do I. And you know, many of the clerks will have been in their offices since 5 o'clock this morning, and will be there until 11 or 12 at night. So don't forget to say thank you to your town clerk when you see them at the polls today.
And one of the things that you'll be doing is compiling some of these results, aren't you, from the presidential election tonight?
Yes, we have a website, election night results. You can go to our website. Or you can Google VT election results, and you'll be able to follow online by town. There's a good graphics. You can see how the Republican Party ballot's going, how the Democratic Party's ballot's going, and you'll actually see the percentages that they're winning by town. So we do have a good system in place now, and it is mandatory for all town clerks to upload their information to us.
Jim, while I've got you on the line, I want to switch subjects just for one question, and that is, any progress on an ethics commission here in the state?
Well, there's a bill in both House and Senate, so they each have a separate bill, and they're both taking testimony on it. So far, it looks like they're probably not going to, I don't know if they're going to set anything up. They're struggling to find funding for it. My response has always been when they ask me, you know, where should we get the money for it, is well, what's the price of democracy? And I mean, really, that's what it's about. What's the price of democracy? What's the price of transparency? They say, well, it's a lot of money, and I get it, but there is a cost to it, and it's a very serious issue, and I'm a little disheartened that they may or may not do anything for the municipal. They may just do it for the state itself, and then of course the legislature has a ruling by their ledge council that it's unconstitutional for an ethics commission to oversee the legislature, that they have to oversee themselves.
How do they do that in other states then?
They must have gotten something through their constitution. I don't know for sure. I believe that there's got to be a way to do this. And frankly, I don't think that the legislature is above anybody else. I'm a former legislator. You're a former legislator. You can't have the fox guarding the hen house. And that's my approach to it. I think we all would be better off, the state would be better off if we have an ethics commission that oversees executive branch, legislative branch, and municipal branch.
Sort of getting back to today, town meeting day, and also a primary day. Jim, what's some words of advice for voters out there? Get out and vote.
Today is an important day for us. It's for my team. It's like a playoff game as we go up to the Super Bowl in November. But this is an important day. This is where the parties actually nominate their presidential candidates. Local towns elect their local officials and settle issues of local concern. Your vote is your voice, so get out there and vote. It's really important, and I'm pretty passionate about it.
Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos, thank you so much, Jim, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Michael. Give me a call if you need me.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to our Radio Vermont studios Karen Horn, who's the director of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns Public Policy and Advocacy. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
What are we seeing out there as dominating sort of the town meeting? What issues are we seeing?
Well, a lot of town meetings are fairly quiet this year. When I left Moortown's town meeting 45 minutes into it, they were almost finished. So very efficient over there today. There are, let's see, there are four towns that have local option taxes on the ballot: Montpelier, Barry City, Hartford, Ludlow, and I may have missed one, but I'm not sure about that. Essex Town is going to vote to adopt a town plan. Marshfield has a climate change ballot item, which calls on the town to take all responsibility and legal actions to reduce fossil fuel use by town operations. That would be an advisory item to the select board. The town of Charlotte's doing something that's pretty interesting. They're looking at adopting maybe a two-tiered system for budget adoption. So you have a vote on town meeting day, and then you would go back and revise the budget in view of that vote, and then not finally adopt it until a little bit later than that. And I think that would be the only town in the state that was doing something like that. Middlebury is eliminating the Office of Town Auditor. Shelburne's voting to appoint the town treasurer. We've had 10 or 12 towns vote to do that in the last couple of years, so that's pretty popular. The town of Sutton and probably all the towns in the Northwest Solid Waste District are voting to adopt the budget for that district. And then, of course, we've got quite a few towns that have resolutions regarding siting of solar facilities. And there are 22 towns that are voting on school district mergers, which interestingly involve 5 supervisory unions and 28 districts altogether.
And that's what I was going to sort of follow up. Usually school budgets are a huge deal. It doesn't seem like they are generating the controversy that they have in the past. Is it because of this consolidation vote? Is that where the controversy is or not?
Well, it'll be really interesting to see what the results are this evening of those votes. I think school districts, because schools are separate governmental entities from the towns, but school districts have made huge efforts to keep their budgets below the threshold for any sort of penalties being imposed, and they've used non-tax dollar funds to do that. So that has taken a little bit of the edge off the discussion. And then there's a number of districts that are actually holding votes later in the year once they have a better handle on what consolidation might look like in their communities. So it's really a sort of year of trying to figure out where you're going.
And town budgets usually aren't controversial, but if you listen to some of the ads here and elsewhere, local option taxes are controversial.
Local option taxes always get a bit of controversy generated. Generally, well, we've heard ads from the Chamber of Commerce and business owners in particular, and those are, generally speaking, the entities that oppose local option taxes. The data tends to show that there's not a drop-off in people going to those establishments as a result of a 1% sales tax or rooms and meals tax. But they are always controversial. We do have, one second here, we have, I've got them.
You've got a stack like I have a stack.
I do. I have a stack of papers. We have one, two, three.
A lot of local options.
14 local option sales tax communities today. And then...
this is wonderful radio as we go silent here.
16 local options, meals, alcoholic beverages, rooms, taxes. Sorry for that.
No problem. As you sort of look past town meeting, some of the issues that you're working on in the legislature are what?
Oh, there's just no end of issues in the legislature. It was interesting this morning when I was at the town meeting again in Moortown, which is where I live. Representative from Moortown was speaking early on, and she's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. And so the first question that came up was around marijuana legalization and how is that going to work and how is her committee going to react to it now that the legislation has passed the Senate. And there's a wide variety of opinions in Moortown as there is across the state. But a lot of the questions that come up around that are about law enforcement, public safety, and obligations that towns would have to deal with things like smoking in public places and the same kinds of issues around cigarette smoking, but as well all of the issues around the black market that's there today. So that's a huge issue. We have no end of water quality type issues that are still percolating, sorry for the pun, in the legislature in the House Fish and Wildlife Committee. S-230 is a bill that would provide some guidance, direction to the Public Service Board around siting of solar facilities. We think that that's a bill that needs to be strengthened and passed this year, despite recent actions of the Public Service Board. There's not, again, interestingly, there's not that much activity around education property taxes from the municipal perspective this year because of the passage of Act 46. So that's not taking as big a chunk of time for us as it has in the past.
We're speaking with Karen Horn, who's the director of Vermont League of Cities and Towns Public Policy and Advocacy Division. And we're talking about town meeting, but also other issues. If you wish to join our conversation, 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. What's happening in your town meeting? What do you think is going on? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Obviously, as you said, marijuana is an issue on people's minds. Has the league taken a position on that?
Well, we have taken a position to oppose the legalization of marijuana this year. We don't think the state of Vermont is ready. There's a huge number of unanswered questions. And you have a number of states out there that have adopted legalization via referendum. We could afford to sit back and see how it plays out in those states. I do want to mention one other thing with respect to a lot of town reports this year, which is there are a host of towns that are writing in their reports about the mandates that are coming from the state government, and that we sort of have a ceaseless stream of new mandates imposed by the state government, a lot of them without the resources to pay for them, and a lot of them with significantly higher requirements for paperwork and just doing drudge work that needs to be done in order to comply with those requirements. And we have quite a few towns that are complaining about the solid waste universal recycling law, Act 148, which went into place, and how they are in fact lacking flexibility to address those issues in ways that have worked for them in the past, particularly in smaller communities that are not part of solid waste districts.
What is the difficulty with this law from a town perspective? What is causing the rub?
Well, part of the problem is that there's a requirement now for pay-as-you-throw. So all of the cost that's imposed that has to be on the waste, so the garbage that you're throwing away, the garbage bag, and recycling is free, quote, free. In fact, of course, recycling is not free, but you have to price it that way. Haulers have to separate their trucks now so that they can take recyclables in one container and garbage in another container, not commingled. And for smaller haulers who are having to make that transition now, it's very expensive. There's discussion in the State House about increasing the solid waste franchise tax from $6 a ton to $12 a ton, which would be another cost on the people who are trying to run the programs. And there's a host of other requirements that come in. What what smaller communities, including the Mad River Resource Alliance, which is Waterbury, Waitsfield, Moortown, based in, there's I think 5 or 6 towns in that, that we had systems in place that worked well and were very good at encouraging people to recycle and to take care of their food residuals. Now it's very dogmatic system, and you have to do it the way the law says, or else you're out of compliance with the statute. So there's not flexibility now.
How do you separate? Is it on the individual to separate and put it out separate, or is it on the hauler to separate these things?
Well, you need to separate in the home. And one of the problems has been, particularly, there's a requirement that every place there's a public waste basket, there has to be a recycling basket right next to it. Those tend to get contaminated, by which I mean people throw trash in the recycling bin. And then you have to sort that all out again, and some of the recyclables are not usable after they've been contaminated. So an individual needs to do it in the home. That's his or her obligation. Businesses need to do it at their place of business.
So I'm trying to figure out, why are the towns upset? Because it seems like the small haulers should be really upset.
They are really upset. Don't worry about that.
What about the towns? What burden does it put on the towns?
One of the issues is that the state has required towns to adopt a pay-as-you-throw ordinance. So these rather small towns have to. Benson is one town that's had real issues with this. Athens and Brunswick are a couple of others. They've adopted pay-as-you-throw ordinances, which means they charge for the trash, and they are supposed to enforce against haulers or people who don't separate the trash, and that's a pretty heavy lift for small towns with very limited staff.
How do you enforce it?
Isn't that a good question?
I'm just curious. Has that issue come up?
Well, the issue has come up. The state says they're not enforcing right now. They're more concerned about the education end of things, but the law does provide for enforcement. And you would go through bags of trash. If you really wanted to get down to it, you go through people's trash.
Let's switch subjects, because I'm here shaking my head on this one. We're speaking with Karen Horn, who's the director of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, and she's the director of the Public Policy and Advocacy Division. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777. I'm a little flustered about how enforcement works on this. That's why I'm sort of sitting here shaking my head. And toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's get back. You had mentioned that marijuana was an issue at the town meeting, but drugs in general, especially in the cities, Rutland, Burlington, St. Johnsbury, are a major issue, especially heroin and some of the opiates. Do you see that as an issue from a Vermont League of Cities and Towns perspective?
That's a huge issue for local governments. We have a huge opiate crisis here in Vermont, as is the case across the nation. We're not exclusive in that respect. It all unfolds on Main Street. Local police departments, where there are police departments, and there's 50-some municipalities out of 246 that have municipal police departments, they are spending a huge amount of time dealing with all of the fallout from the opiate crisis, including being counselors and helping people with mental health issues and doing a lot of things that you would not traditionally think were police responsibilities. And then you have all of the non-law enforcement issues associated with addiction.
We're speaking with Karen Horn, who is the director of the Public Policy and Advocacy Division for the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. When we return, Karen, I want to talk a little bit more about water quality, siting, healthcare, and divestment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Karen Horn, who is the director of the Public Policy and Advocacy Division of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. We've talked about things that are the issues that are going on in town meeting as we speak, and also other issues that are happening that affect cities and towns. And one of the things that I have heard on this program, but also in general, is the issue of siting, both solar siting and wind siting. Towns and individuals feel excluded, at least what I'm hearing, feel excluded from the process. Can you explain what is going on out there?
Yeah, sure. It's very true that towns are feeling excluded from the process. The Public Service Board is a three-member panel, quasi-judicial board. They are the body that makes the decisions about whether a facility can go forward or not, or any kind of energy generation facility, actually, including the transmission lines that are being discussed. The process for municipalities to get involved is very legalistic, not just municipalities, anybody really. The board is supposed to give, quote, due consideration to municipal recommendations and municipal plans when they consider whether or not to site a facility. There have actually been only, as far as I know, three solar facilities rejected by the Public Service Board and 1,000 or so permitted. The most recent rejection was Bennington Chelsea Solar, and it was just a couple of weeks ago. It's a big project, and the Public Service Board actually cited the Bennington Land Use Plan as being a good example of a plan that addressed specifically the areas that they did not want those kinds of developments to go in. But really, it's the first time the board's done that. Around the state, right now, you've got 95 towns that have adopted a resolution calling on the legislature to take action to give more say to the municipalities in the whole process.
And what does that mean, Karen, more say?
Well, we've been advocating for the board to be required to give substantial consideration instead of due consideration, so a higher level of standing to local government plans and recommendations. We've asked that the Public Service Board be required to answer each recommendation in the body of their decision, and if they are not going to agree with the municipality, to say why they are not. We're not asking for a veto, and that's something that's thrown out there quite frequently, but the League of Cities and Towns has never asked for a veto in the process. But we do want the Public Service Board to understand that there's not only the larger public good of getting to renewable energy 90% by 2050, but there's also a public good around what projects' impacts are going to be in cities and towns around the state.
If a town has to do a town plan in order to put in solar and wind siting issues, mm-hmm. is that a burden? Do most towns have a town plan, and do most towns have this provision already in it?
We have 200 and some towns that have town plans in place. And since the 1970s, actually, if you're going to have a town plan, you've had to have an energy element in it. Those used to be fairly perfunctory items, but they've gotten more and more detailed as this issue has come to the fore. And you have a number of towns now that have pretty detailed energy elements. And so we're hoping that since volunteer boards and communities have voted to support that level of detail, that the Public Service Board has an obligation to respond to it.
Last year, we're speaking with Karen Horn, Director of the Public Policy and Advocacy Division of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, and we started out talking about town meeting and some of the issues that are in town meeting. We're sort of ventured into some of the bigger issues that affect cities and towns, and one of them last year when you were in here, or 7 months ago when you were in here, was the Lake Champlain cleanup effort, the bill that was passed by the legislature. And if I remember correctly, there was a lot of requirements that were sort of heaved onto cities and towns with that bill. What is the progress? And if I remember right, there was a lot of expenses that were heaved onto cities and towns because of that bill.
So the estimates are that it's going to take about $100 million per year for the next 10 years in order to meet the requirements of the Vermont Clean Water Act that was passed last year.
And what are those requirements?
And, well, we don't have time to go through all of them.
The bigger ones.
But municipal wastewater treatment plants that are closer to the lake are going to have to increase their phosphorus removal from their facilities. There's a huge number of requirements on agriculture to reduce flow of stormwater to the lake. And if you recall last Thursday where we had that storm and there was 4 feet of water on Route 2 between Middlesex and Moortown, that was all stormwater runoff. As the public works director in Rutland City said at the time, the entire state of Vermont was an impervious surface last week. It was all frozen. So the idea of the Clean Water Act is to reduce that flow in storm events to the waters of the state. Every town is going to have to have a municipal roads permit. It's a brand new permit. It's being phased in. It's going to require you to do inventories of your road, assess the vulnerable areas, and then come up with capital plans to address those vulnerabilities, upsize culverts, replace culverts, change the contours of your road, stone line ditches, all those kinds of things. And you are going to start to see those items in municipal budgets in the next couple of years, because there's nothing like enough money to pay for those projects coming from the state.
Let's keep on the subject just for a moment of water quality. In Bennington, they're having a water problem with their contaminated wells that are sort of, it's seeping from what they believe is an old factory, and some of it has contaminated the wells. Are we seeing water quality issues throughout municipalities, or is it fairly concentrated in various areas?
Well, you have a number of public water systems, both private and public, not to get into the details, but a lot of public water systems are actually privately owned. But from time to time, you see those kinds of issues. You'll see a boil water notice be put out. I don't really recall a situation like Bennington's in the recent past. I think the last one was around a dry cleaning facility down in Williamstown years and years ago. So there's not too many of those. There aren't that many surface water supplies that are actually public water supplies now. Montpelier has a surface water supply, having said that.
One of the things that is causing some, controversy in the legislature and throughout state government is the call for divestment from coal and one oil company. What's the league's position on divestment?
We passed a resolution last year at the league board level that called on the legislature essentially to let the pension investment committees do their job and not pass mandates on what they could or could not invest in. I think it's a conversation that's being had at the pension investment committees for municipal employees and also for teachers and state employees. But really, those are the people with expertise, and we need to let them make decisions that are in the best interest of the retirees of municipalities in the state.
One of the things, you are a big provider of health care, and that's one of the things I want to get at. You were a big provider of health care. What has changed in the health care realm from your perspective, because you were, if you could just explain what the change is, and how has it been going for municipalities?
Well, I think it's been going for municipalities about the same way it has for everybody else, which is a bit rocky. We did provide health insurance to actually most of the municipalities in the state. We don't provide that now. I think I'm not the expert on healthcare, I should say, but I think our experience is really not that much different from any other sector of the economy at this point.
And you, depending on the size, you have what they call direct access now. Most municipalities have direct access because the Vermont Health Connect has been having problems. So you're considered a business. They have direct access to the insurance companies. That probably has lessened the problems a little bit.
Well, I think that at the time that we were first allowed to do that was absolutely necessary. It just was not working the other way. And there is bill in the legislation, in the legislature right now, that would continue to allow businesses to have direct access. We have also signed on to a call for a study about expanding Dr. Dinosaur to all people under 26 years of age. And it's just a study, and we would like to see what it looks like if that kind of system were implemented and if actually that would be more beneficial and less expensive for Vermonters than the current system.
Last question, and it deals with healthcare. There has been calls for an independent evaluation of the Vermont Health Connect. Has the league taken any position on that?
We haven't yet.
What's I just said last question, and that's not the case. I'm going to ask you one more. What's the number one issue out there for municipalities?
Wow, that's a big question. I think siting is huge for some municipalities. Implementing the Water Quality Act is huge for municipalities. They're really just addressing the transportation funding. We've had level funding for municipal highway programs for 7 or 8 years, and that's a big problem, something we'd like to talk about a little bit more with legislators. So there's a lot of issues.
I want to thank our guests this morning, Karen Horn, Director of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns Division of Public Policy and Advocacy. She's joined us in studio to talk about town meeting issues and other issues as well. You know what we're going to do tomorrow? Guess what? We're going to wrap up what is going on nationally in politics. And tomorrow's guest will be Eric Davis, who's the Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, and Steve Terry, who is the WCAX Political Analyst in studio. And we'll talk about Super Tuesday results. And then we're going to have Josh Kelly, and he's with the Waste Management and Prevention Division of A&R. And guess what we're going to be talking about? We're going to be talking about the new waste management and recycling requirements in the state. There's a lot of confusion out there, and we want to find out what are some of the problems that are going on. One of the things I want to thank everybody today for their phone calls. We've had a busy, busy day today, and with politics, we'll continue that discussion tomorrow. Obviously, this is a big night tonight, both with town meeting, get out and vote, and with Super Tuesday, the presidential election, get out and vote. That was Jim Condo's advice, get out and vote for your candidate. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont. 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barry, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at wdevradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.